I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Charlie Demers joins me again. He has just published a new novel, Primary Obsessions. It is not his first novel, but it is his first foray into the genre of mystery. Even with this new book just out, he's working on the second book in a series featuring his protagonist, Dr. Anik Boudreau. She is a psychiatrist of a particular practice, cognitive behavioral therapy. I'll get Charlie, who illuminates this condition in his book, to tell us about it and about his own experience as a CBT patient. In the book, Dr. Boudreau's patient, Sanjay, is tortured with violent thoughts and horrified by them. He is annoyed with his roommate, and as one expects, the roommate is murdered. Dr. Boudreau feels compelled to investigate the murder on her own when she is unable to talk to the police owing to doctor-patient confidentiality. I'll get Charlie to talk to us about this book, these characters, and more. We also discuss his own publishing and the Vancouver that he depicts in this book. Charles Demers is an author, comedian, actor, playwright, screenwriter, and political activist. His comedy album, Fatherland, was nominated for a Juno Award. He appears regularly on the CBC radio program, The Debaters, and has written several books, including his previous novel, Property Values. His book of essays, Vancouver Special, was a finalist for the Hubert Evans BC Book Prize for Nonfiction, which he first appeared on this program with in 2010. Since then, he's made several appearances, this being his ninth. His website is at charliedemers.com. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Charlie Demers. Mr. Demers, good morning.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks for keeping it formal. I feel like we can go to a first name basis once I'm at like about my 15th appearance the podcast. Yeah,
I can start calling you Chuck, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Plante. Yeah. And then I think once we hit Chaz, the relationship goes supernova, and then just collapses in upon itself.
Well, we'll just talk like millennials and just grunt at each other, right?
Yeah, using all pictography.
Yeah, indeed. So this
thanks very much for having me back.
You're very welcome. This novel was supposed to be out in the spring, but because of everything that's happened, it didn't come out, I guess, until September. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, in some ways, 2020 will always be remembered as the year Charlie Demers' book got slightly held up. I was, and judging by the responses I got from, when Douglas and McIntyre made the decision to hold, in the spring, I thought that was clearly the wisest move, and I sent a very short but a very grateful email, extolling the wisdom of the decision, and I got a bunch of emails back, like from people at Westwood Creative, my agency, who had been copied on the email, saying like that was a very good email. Like I guess a whole bunch of authors who had been delayed,
right,
were angry that their books were being delayed in the spring, which I just thought was so insane. I mean, this is speculation on my part, but that was the impression that I got from it seemed to me, it would just been absolutely insane trying to get something out in the spring. Now we put out the third book from the Robin's Egg humor imprint in the summer, which was Paul Bay's book, You Suck, Sir, and that didn't get held. That went ahead in the spring and actually ended up being a bit of a hit. It was on the bestseller list, and people really liked it. But in that case, I think there was something specifically about the book that spoke to the time. I mean, people were staying home from school, and so there was something comforting about the classroom setting, and there was something as well about, you know, this Asian Canadian teacher in this time when there was this kind of nasty anti-Asian racism creeping back up to the fore And so I think there were a few books that were of the right moment in the spring, and were able to find an audience. But I think for most things, it would have just been a nightmare to try and compete with this totally, just biblical, news cycle. So I was thrilled when we held till the fall. I thought it was the right move, still do. And, I was, very happy. So we came out for, September 26th. And, because all the physical copies of the book existed before that, that wasn't a hard, like, embargo date. Yeah. Things started trickling out, before then. But, it's been really nice.
And that book, by the way, that you mentioned, Paul Bay's book, it's a terrific book. I bought it in the, whenever it came out, I guess in the spring. And, there are moments in that book that are just, they're lovely and they're hilarious, and well, that's what he is, I guess, isn't it? Isn't he?
Yeah. It was so wonderful to get to. He's my old sketch comedy partner. Mm-hmm. We had a comedy duo for a few years, and he's a dear friend, and I think of him like an older brother, and in some ways a much older brother. And he was the MC at my wedding. He was, but we haven't really had anything. We haven't had a chance to work on anything creatively together in a long time. Although I mean, that's not exactly true. Sorry, I did an episode of a couple of episodes of his podcast. It was just terrific to get to work on that book, and it was. I was really proud of it, and I was so thrilled that it got the reception that it did, which is pretty much rapturous. People just really loved it.
Indeed, yeah. So to your novel, Primary Obsessions, Dr. Anique Boudreau, what does she look like?
She is. She has a shaved head, which was a sort of symbolic act for me to disconnect her from her real-life inspiration. So Dr. Anique Boudreau is based on my real-life psychologist, who I've been seeing for about 17 years, sometimes very regularly. Sometimes, not seeing her for a couple months at a time. But I've been receiving cognitive behavioral therapy from this doctor for, the much better part of 20 years, since I was about 23, 24 years old. I'm still trying to keep her name secret, although she told me that one of her patients came in last week and said in the middle of the session, so I guess you solve crimes now. So I don't think it's very, I don't think I've hidden her identity super well, but in real life, my psychologist has very, very long hair. And so on the very first page of the book, I established that Anique has shaved her head. She shaved her head in the world of the book in solidarity with her niece who had cancer, but then stuck with the look because she liked it. And that shaved head was my way of saying, okay, even if the psychologist was inspired by my real life psychologist, she is her own, she's her own person. She's a fictional creation. And so the shaved head is more important for me as the author. And then I think she is, I think she's very attractive. I've gotten a lot of feedback from readers, mostly female readers, but at least one male reader who who liked the fact that Anik was not like a eunuch, like that she actually has a sort of a sexual life and a romantic life, and that she, you know, she has different parts of her personality that we, I think, see over the course of the book. So when she's in the office, she is she's a doctor, and when she's at home, she's a partner. And, you know, partly the book is a bit about her getting thrown into a situation that kind of blurs her commitments as a doctor and as a, just a person. So, yeah, it was really important for me that we kind of see all sides of her. But she's, I think she's youngish.
Yeah.
Though not a kid. She's closer to the beginning of her career than to the end of it. But she's not fresh out of school or anything. She's also, she's one of the people who gets to enjoy all of Vancouver because she has the money to do it. And that was another part of writing the book that was fun was, you know, writing somebody who can afford a condo in Cole Harbour.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fascinating view onto the city and Vancouver itself. As I remember when I read the novel, seemed like a character itself in the story. What was the reason to do that? I mean, it is a city that confounds us a lot. You know, it upsets us. It pisses us off a lot. But it's still, at the end of the day, a pretty good city compared to others, say.
Yeah, and I think, to me, that's part of the deal with detective fiction. I mean, that's part of what you're buying with the price of admission, is you are getting shown around a place. And you're usually being shown around a place that the author feels very ambivalently or ambiguously or complex feelings about. Mm-hmm. So, for me, the detective series that is, you know, for me most consistently, the one I keep going back to is the Inspector Montalbano series by Andrea Camilleri. And, he wrote the first Inspector Montalbano book, kind of as a literary challenge to himself in response to Leonardo Sciascia's comment that you could never write a mystery set in Sicily. I think the idea was that, you know, in Sicily, the laws itself and the law itself and the society itself is, you know, is such a kind of warped or unpredictable thing, mm-hmm. that you couldn't set something as clockwork as a mystery novel in that world. And so Camilleri wrote the first Montalbano book as a challenge, basically, to that, you know, throwing down of the gauntlet. And if you read those books, you know, it's totally clear that here's a guy who, absolutely has Sicily in his bones. I mean, I genuinely think that no one who's truly of a place or truly feels a place can just say, oh, I love this town or I'm a booster of this town. Like, yeah. if you really feel a place, you're going to, you know, hate it as much as you love it. You're going to be frustrated and confounded by it as much as you adore it, because it's just, it means everything to you. And so, to me, that's kind of, it's one of the things about buying a mystery novel is that you're getting a ticket to the town that the author's writing about, and They're going to show you what's great about it. They're going to show you what sucks about it. They're going to show you what they know about it or what they hope about it. And so I got to write a slightly more romantic version of the city because, you know, my main character is outside of my tax bracket. But it's still, you know, fundamentally, it's still the Vancouver that I'm familiar with.
So Sanjay is another character in the book. Why does he see Dr. Boudreau?
So Sanjay has a subset of obsessive compulsive disorder called primary obsessions, OCD. So primary obsessions, OCD, is what I went initially to see the real life Dr. Boudreau about when I was about Sanjay's age. Basically, the way that primary obsessions, OCD, works is, you know, when we think about OCD culturally, we tend to concentrate on the C part, the compulsion. And primary obsessions is the name, is full obsession. And so it tends to be that someone will be beset by intrusive, unwanted thoughts that are of a disturbing nature, and that the person just can't bring themselves to stop having. And then sometimes, or usually, compulsions will then grow out of that as a way of canceling out the thoughts, or canceling out the guilt from the thoughts. So in primary obsessions, OCD, the disturbing intrusive thoughts are typically divided into three organizing categories. The categories are blasphemous thoughts, violence, or sexual inappropriateness. And essentially, the way that it works is people with primary obsessions, OCD, have the same thoughts as anybody else does. I mean, everyone in the world has had the kinds of thoughts that set off primary obsessions, OCD. So, so to take an example of one of these thoughts that everyone has, or something like everyone has had. You're standing on a SkyTrain platform. There's an old man, you know, standing a little bit too close to the yellow line. Maybe he's standing over the yellow line. And some little part of your brain goes, what if I pushed him onto the tracks? And for 99% of people, they have that thought. Maybe they giggle a little bit about how totally out of character it is. Or maybe they go, thought, why would I think that? Yeah. But they put it away. But most people, the statistically overwhelming majority of people, know that thoughts like that are basically mental garbage. But what happens with patients who have primary obsessions, OCD, is an error of interpretation. So someone with primary obsessions, OCD, will have that thought and think, wow, that thought is so disturbing that it must say something very important and significant about me and who I am. Do I want to hurt that man? Why do I want to hurt that man? Well, am I a violent person? Well, no, I'm not really a violent person. Well, although I guess there was that time when I was seven and I hit my little brother with that, you know, with that piece of wood, or, you know, whatever, what, you know, you start going through. And so basically, it's an error of interpretation that leads to a short circuiting of the fight or flight, anxiety system, because the way human beings genetically are wired to search for danger is that we scan our surroundings for presence in order to confirm absence. So that's a very technical way of saying if you're in the forest mm-hmm. and you're afraid that there might be a bear, you look to see a bear in order to confirm that there is no bear. Mm. So you look for a bear, and then when you don't see a bear, you're assured that you are safe. The problem is, if you apply that same if you apply that same logic to a thought, there's a pernicious logic that gets back to what people like George Lakoff in his book Don't Think of an Elephant. If I say to you, don't think of an elephant, the one thing you can't do is not think of an elephant.
Right.
So
yeah.
if I say to myself thoughts that I'm having, I need to make sure that I don't have thoughts like that. Then your brain starts thinking that it's helping you. Your brain starts going, oh, you mean thoughts like this or thoughts like that? Or how about thoughts like that? You start scanning for presence in order to confirm absence, the same way you would with a bear, but now you've stumbled into basically a glitch in the technology of your brain, and so people with primary obsessions OCD have gotten themselves into a place where these thoughts continue to gain more and more significance to them because they keep having them more and more because they keep struggling and fighting them harder and harder because they're increasingly disturbed by them and also increasingly convinced that they're saying something true or scary or frightening about who that person really, quote unquote, really is. It's an absolutely heartbreaking disorder.
Yeah.
The most heartbreaking cases I think are sometimes young parents, new parents, will suddenly become seized with the fear that they'll do something inappropriate with their infant or mm-hmm. something like that,
yeah.
and become suddenly obsessed by the idea. It can be just an absolutely life-ruining thing. And so that's what Sanjay is experiencing. The reason he gets into the jeopardy he gets into, or part of what keeps him in the jeopardy that he's in, is that he's absolutely confined by this crippling shame about the thoughts, which is very much something that, when I was a young man at the beginning of my treatment, that's really something very much that I experienced and that my real life doctor, basically kind of saved my life by working me through.
So I guess one isn't ever cured of it, but that's why it's called therapy, and that it allows the patient, say, to deal with it.
I would say, for all intents and purposes, I consider myself cured.
Okay.
I mean, if you compare, I have little flare ups now and again,
mm-hmm.
and I have to remind myself of the fundamental principles of my therapy and I have to, but these days when I see, my psychologist, it's much more typical that we'd be talking about generalized anxiety disorder or mm-hmm. depression and stuff like that.
Yeah.
OCD, has gone from something that made me, It absolutely beggars my ability to put into words the change in quality of life for me that the cognitive behavioral therapy has had in terms of my OCD, where I literally, when I was a teenager or a young man, I didn't know if I would just life was not worth living. I mean, it was just an absolutely immiserated, completely for me, at times disconnected from reality, and now it's a challenging but beautiful thing to be alive, and I owe an enormous amount of that to my doctor, and that's part of what this book was about, was writing something in tribute to the person who without putting too fine a point on it, saved my life.
And then I guess the ability to write about it, as you have, and to tell us what CBT is these last few minutes, I guess that is a sign, I guess, that when one understands what it is, they're able to grow out of it, if you will, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably say work through it as opposed to grow out of it, because
right.
I don't think there's any chance that I would have organically gotten there on my own. I think what I would have done instead is just sort of kept on prescribing my life. The thing with anxiety disorders is that the therapy that's needed to work through them involves going against the thing that feels good in the moment. I mean, it's a little bit like addiction therapy in that way. So, for instance, when I first started talking to friends or loved ones about my OCD, I felt so liberated by the feeling of no longer keeping all this stuff secret that I would then start asking friends and loved ones for reassurance about, these thoughts aren't really me, right? Like, this is not really, I don't have to worry about this, do I? And, I had friends who, this was in the days of landlines, pre-text.
Yeah.
I would phone them, 6-7 times a night, and they would reassure me, and actually, reassurance is a way of bolstering the significance of the thoughts. It feels good in the moment, but what it actually does is strengthen the thoughts in the long term. So if I hadn't had a doctor come in and say, you need to fight the urge to turn to your friends or later turn to your wife, and ask for reassurance on this, I don't think I ever would have done that on my own.
Yeah. The book is such a compelling book because of what's in it, obviously, but the characters especially. And so my understanding is that this is the first in a series. Is that right?
Yeah, we have. Thank you very much for that. We have signed to do two books with D&M, Douglas and McIntyre in North America, and then it's kind of exciting for me that for the first time ever I've sold United Kingdom rights, and so Legend in Britain will be putting out both books as well, and then we'll see where it goes from there. We'll see if there's any juice. And we'll see if there's any interest in moving on after a second book.
Right.
But my hope is to basically allow for Dr. Boudreau to solve a mystery in each book that would center around a new theme in mental health in each case. So the second book is called Suicide Thoughts, and it's about depression, mm-hmm. and And I think actually, I think that one will be really right up your alley, because it's a bit more sort of plugged into the world of Vancouver politics. And hopefully that one will be a little bit less of the Cole Harbour side of the city, and a little bit more of the you know, what remains of the seamy underbelly.
Right. This isn't your first novel, but it's the first murder mystery. Was this always a genre that you liked reading, say?
I loved, like, the kind of kid mysteries when I was little. Like, I loved the kind of Encyclopedia Brown. Like, I ate that stuff up. And then as I got older, I just kind of got myself stuck in that place of feeling like if you're reading fiction, it's always got to be literary fiction. And so when I said this around property values, but mm-hmm. it was really you know, I went on Cheryl McKay's show, North by Northwest on CBC, and she asked me for my guilty pleasure readings. Mm-hmm. and I didn't have any, and then a little while later I was looking for something just fun to read in my house. I mean, I have, you know, I've got over 1,000 books in my house, and I couldn't find anything. Yeah. Like, this one night, I was, you know, my daughter was still a baby, and I was just exhausted, and I just wanted to read something that would be... And so it was actually kind of fairly late that I kind of came back into reading crime fiction, whether it's like the sort of... crime fiction of, say, like an Elmore Leonard, or if it's you know, straightforwardly, you know, mystery, yeah. You know, Agatha Christie, or you know, even Arthur Conan Doyle's, or then, you know,
Philip Marlowe.
Yeah, I do like you know, it's funny actually. I just watched The Big Sleep, which I read in, and it's funny because I the thing about The Big Sleep, which is supposed to be this, you know, triumph of unpretentious, non-literary, you know, plot-driven work, it's so complex, the story, that you can't, and it's true of the movie as well, you cannot follow the story. So all you really can do is take pleasure in the sentences, or take pleasure in the characters, and take pleasure. And all of a sudden you're like, well, how is this any different from the way that I would read a literary novel? So, but yeah, I mean, Chandler's amazing, and then you've got people like, you know, my pal Sam Weeb, who is just, I mean, you know, that was another reason why I thought, well, I'll put Anik in a version of Vancouver that, you know, is a little bit less anxious about, you know, the transformation of the city, because I just feel like his Wakeland books, they already capture the anxiety about a transforming Vancouver so well that I just felt like if I try to do that, it's just gonna put me in a place where I'm getting compared to somebody I can't possibly measure up to. So, you know, there's so much good work being done in the genre in a contemporary way, and there's mm-hmm. there's so much good stuff that already exists, and there's also just so much less anxiety about the writing. It just feels like I remember going to one of the noir at the bar readings that Dietrich Kaltis put on at the Irish Heather.
Mm-hmm.
And just like everybody's reading and listening, and there was none of the kind of like status jockeying or like weird deal envy or weird kind of like, it was just like I was just amazed by how much everyone reading there actually was listening to each other's writing and really just kind of interested in each other's books, and mm-hmm. and it's a nice place to be.
Indeed, indeed. The mindset of the writer, though, to attempt a murder mystery, I would assume, is different than, say, the other writing you've done heretofore. Do you find that you have to draw upon new skills, say, as you're writing a murder mystery as you do?
I don't know if it's drawing upon new skill, but it was definitely anxiety about whether I've done this right or whether I've done this in a way where I've never written a book before this one where I was so aware of the audience or the reader's participation in defining in a really well-defined way whether or not the book is a success.
Mm-hmm.
It's way less subjective in a lot of ways. I mean, there are always going to be subjective things around, you know, are the sentences beautiful? Are the characters compelling? But then there's stuff like, you know, there's stuff like fair play. There's stuff like red herring. There's stuff mm-hmm. like, you know, are there enough plausible suspects? Did you tip your hand too early? Was the culprit, too obscure in such a way that it wasn't really a fair mystery to begin with? Like, it's just all this kind of stuff that you're working in a genre where there are, you know, these kind of very well established and agreed upon rules, and I've never written anything in that world before, so I definitely I had a lot more anxiety this time about am I doing this right? Do I know the rules well enough? Like, have I metabolized them or internalized them enough that I can think through this stuff? And I was very lucky to have a wonderful editor, Caroline Skelton, and she's going to be working on the second book as well, and she was thinking about the second book while we were editing this first one, and mm-hmm. so that was great too, because that's the other thing, is you're trying to, you know, write a character whose story doesn't end at the end of your book, and that's another, like, that's something that's very attractive about creating a detective character. But it means also that you want to create somebody who you can spend a certain amount of time with, and that you want to see more of as an author, let alone for readers, and who you've left some runway for so that she can move in new directions.
I'm not a writer, but obviously read a fair bit. As I'm reading the book, I obviously realize that it can be hard work. You just said that it, at times it filled you with anxiety writing this book, but it also seemed, as a reader, that you were having fun. Were you?
Oh, good. Yes, definitely. I mean, absolutely. And I mean, I think, at this stage, I mean, look, I'm at a point now, and I don't say this to be fatalistic. I don't say this to be poor me or anything like that. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm six books in. If I was going to be a big literary star, we'd know by now. Like, you know, I write books and I can get them published, and a few people will even read them.
Yeah.
And you know, with property values, that got optioned, and we got to write a screenplay, and who knows, maybe in a post-COVID situation, that movie will even get made. I mean, I'm not trying to poo-poo anything, but I'm also not. I know there's not going to be any New Yorker profiles on me as a writer. There's not going to be. I know that when I die, if I'm remembered for anything, it's going to be he was a comedian who also wrote books. And so all of that is just to say, like, there's books are never going to be how my family gets calories. Like, it's never going to be, you know, it's going to be part of the income.
Yeah.
It's going to be part of the, but all of that is just to say there's really no point in me writing anything at this point that's not fun, or that I don't think I'm gonna like doing. And so I totally had fun getting to imagine this woman's life. I had fun, you know, tooling around the city, in a different social class, in a different gender, in a different, you know, in a different body, in a, you know, it's these are the things that, you know, these are the things that you get to do if you make up a story. I don't know. I just realized, as I said that sounds maybe like, appropriation language. But that's part of what happens with fiction, right? You make up a character and you get to be that character for a little while. In this case, it was a character who was inspired by someone who I have not only deep admiration and affection for, but someone to whom I owe a very great deal. And so it was. I absolutely had fun. Even anxious fun is fun.
Now, finally, you mentioned you've written a number of books, six, I think you said. You turned 40 recently, I understand.
Yeah.
When you look back at it all, these past 40 years, 20 mm-hmm. years ago, 35 years ago, are you at a place that you could have imagined, say, as a kid, doing what you want to do even?
It's a really great question. You know, as you can imagine, turning 40 during lockdown year, you definitely get a lot of extra time for that kind of meditation. The added thing, just to throw into the mix, for me in turning 40. Was that my mother died when she was 39. Mm-hmm. And her dad died when he was 33. So for me, my 30s was always this time that I was either, I was always afraid that I wouldn't get through them. I was always afraid that I would not turn 40, or at least that was the explicit fear.
Mm-hmm.
And then the implicit fear, and I realized this kind of talking to my brother, we were kind of going over this stuff. The implicit fear was that I would get to 40 and then have no idea what to do on the other side of it. So I found a my dad moved from his house in Halifax into a condo a few blocks away. And I was going through some stuff at his place, and found an assignment that I did in 1989. So this was to imagine where we would be. I forget what year it was, if it was where we would be in 2009 or 2019 or whatever. It was, but it was to imagine our lives. And the degree to which the life I have is like the one that the 9-year-old me pictured and wanted was like staggering. Right down to like I was in the thing, I was like, I wake up at 10 a.m. and I blah blah blah, like from the time of day where I get to wake up to like you know, obviously in the version that I wrote when I was a kid, it was like, it was a much more spectacular level of success. I was the second John Candy, and I was, you know, I lived in Hollywood, and I was I was a comedian, and I was all of this. And as I was reading it, I was kind of amazed, because I as you can probably tell from the way that I have talked over the years coming on the show, I have not found life to be a particularly easy thing. And there've been a lot of tough spots, and then I'm going over this thing and realizing that the degree to which my life lines up with what I always wanted is pretty staggering. And I think many people would point out, and there's probably something to it, that like, yeah, you're a white English speaking straight man in North America, and there's no doubt that played its part in that as well. I would say one of the other things that played its part was that I was able to get cognitive behavioral therapy free of charge, which is not an option right now. And when I think back on that, that to me is the most humbling thing in my life, because if I hadn't been able to see my doctor as part of a clinical trial at the UBC Anxiety Clinic, if I hadn't been able to start seeing her for free, I wouldn't have been able to see her at all. So, and I believe me, there's a there but for the grace of God feeling that I have whenever I reflect on that. In some ways, I'm very aware of the fact that I kind of lived my life on this kind of sprint rhythm in order to kind of beat this deadline of 40. And in a lot of ways, I felt like I was doing things at the wrong pace. What I have become very grateful for is that have been able in recent years to have a chance to reflect on certain, I guess, spiritual dimensions of of life, and reassess what I had defined as what I wanted, or what I needed, or what a successful life looked like. And my hope is that I can get a deepened appreciation from what comes next out of life, because I think there's two ways you can look at finding a piece of paper that says you lived up to all the dreams you had in grade four. You can either say, hey, look, I won. I got exactly what I wanted. Or you can say, huh, it's kind of sad that a grown man never never came up with anything more enriched or sophisticated or complex to ask from life than what he thought to ask out of it when he was 9 years old. And I'm hoping to spend what I hope is the second half of my life living in a different register, and not abandoning or walking away from that work, but thinking about it in a different sort of aspect, or different perspective.
This got way deeper than I thought it would get.
COVID has wrecked me for small talk. It's either pure existential abyss, or or did you remember to wash your hands? That's my, which I guess is just two ways of saying the same thing.
Indeed. This hour has just whizzed by. There's so many things I want to ask you still, but I'll let you go because well, I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Joseph. It's always always such a pleasure. I love what you do, and I just every time I come on, I love it.
Well, you're very kind. Congratulations on this book, Charlie, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks a lot.
The website for more is at charliedemers.com. The book is called Primary Obsessions. It is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Charlie Demers. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.